I had the pleasure of meeting her in Boise this past year when I went to a service seminar, and I got to hear her speak then, and it was wonderful for me. And we've invited her to speak this afternoon. Her name is Blanche, and she's from Austin, Texas. Please welcome her.
My name is Blanche, and I am a grateful recovering Al-Anon. Hi.
Hi.
And I have been a member of the Al-Anon family groups since July 7, 1964. And when I tell you that, I tell you that I came into Al-Anon in Texas because we give dates in Texas. And I have taken the privilege through the years of doing away from home what makes me feel comfortable, and that does. 20 years in Al-Anon does not mean I'm a savior, it means I'm a survivor, okay? Let's have no illusions about each other. I would be remiss in my good manners if I didn't thank the committee for the invitation to come be with you, and for the delicious food and the beautiful accommodations and the smiles of welcome on your faces. I appreciate Betty and BJ and Jessica meeting my train yesterday. I'd begun to think I might not get here. We have had a winter in Texas that you would not believe, and we are ill-equipped to handle anything below freezing, much less three snows, which we've had this month. I thought I was coming up here to get warm. It was 12 degrees when I left Texas, and it was about that much below zero when I got to Denver. So we had a two-hour delay because the fuel trucks were frozen, and I don't think they're used to anything quite that cold. You understand, we didn't have winters like that until all the Yankees moved to Texas. For the last 4 or 5 years, the Midwest has just been emptying into Texas. We've been guarding the wrong river. I am glad to be back in Oregon. It has been 8 years since I was with you before. I was beginning to wonder if it was something I had said, that you weren't going to let me come back. I enjoyed Jack's talk last night so much, and something he said about England made me want to tell you about my experience there. I was there for a month a few years ago in the summer, and I was visiting English friends who are not in the program, but they understood that I wanted to make some meetings and made it possible for me to do so. And the first one was an open meeting, an AA meeting. They had, as we often do, they had an Al-Anon and an AA speaker. And their meetings lasted an hour and a half, at least this one did. The speakers took 20, 30 minutes each, and then there was time for discussion. And people would say to one of the speakers, when you were talking about it, made me think of, and I liked that, I thought it worked out very well. Toward the end, the chairman said, I understand we have a visiting American Al-Anon here. Would you like to tell us your name and where you're from? Now, to my credit, and I have witnesses, I did not leave my seat. And in 2 or 3 minutes, I told them my name and where I was from. And that I was glad to be there. And somebody said, did you notice any difference in the meetings here in Texas? And I said, not in any way that matters. Oh, I said, when someone's introduced, we generally say hi to the person and call him by name, and we applaud when people are finished. But those are just mechanics. Certainly nothing that mattered. And I chatted on a few more minutes, and when I hushed, somebody said, hi, Blanche, and they applauded. And that warmed my heart, and I was home, you know. Accents or not, I was home. And that's the way I feel with you, and I'm really glad to be with you. I have been trying the last several years, when I am allowed to share Al-Anon in other places, to be as open and as vulnerable as I know how. I want to speak to you from my heart and not my head, because you told me early on that that which does not come from the heart does not reach the heart. And I very much want to reach your hearts this afternoon. And so that means I'll have to ask you, if you will please, to listen to me with your hearts and to try to love me back while I am talking to you. Because it's a risk. It would be much easier to talk about the program than myself. I did that for a number of years. It's easier to tell you what I think than how I feel. But that isn't what I want to do. I'm here to participate and not to perform. And so I will count on your loving me back. And some of you have indicated that you've heard my story before, or you've heard a tape. You could have had a nap this afternoon. I mean, I just have one story, and I'm not going to go out and do it over again, so I'll have something different to tell you. If ever the stories are the same. I don't know about you, but I have done a great deal of hurting and rejoicing and loving and learning since we were last together. I dare say you have too. So we meet at a different place on our spiritual journey. We touch at a different place. Well, I came into Al-Anon kicking and screaming and clutching my halo and protesting to everyone who would listen and a lot of people who weren't interested. But I had not done the drinking and I did not need the therapy, thank you very much. And I wrapped my robes of righteousness about me. And think about it now, I'm so grateful that God led me to a group of people who were serious about recovery. Because what I know of the principles of this program today, I know not because I read them or someone told them to me, but because they were practiced lovingly and tenderly on me. And at a time when I was unlovable. This group tolerated me when I was condescending and patronizing and well-nigh intolerable. And it was not a ladies' auxiliary or a sewing circle or a coffee clutch, but a group of people who wanted to get well. I used to say I came in as a typical Al-Anon because I thought everyone came in angrily and reluctantly. That's not so. And I quit using the term typical because that brings different pictures to different minds. It depends on your idea of what one is in the first place. I think I maybe stop here and dispel some rumors. One is that all alcoholics, without exception, are either handsome or beautiful, talented, intelligent, charming, sensitive, and sexy. Have you heard that one? I never get any argument on that. But the myth I would like to dispel is that they are inevitably married to dull, mousy people. If that's your idea of a typical Al-Anon, you can forget it. Or meet me after the meeting and we'll have a talk about it. And then there are those who feel that the non-alcoholic in the family sat home knitting, you know, Priscilla Pureheart, while the alcoholic was out doing his thing, or hers as the case may be. And some of us were, but some of us did the same thing the alcoholic did, and we did them cold sober. And so let's don't have any illusions about each other today. It's going to come out later in my story that I was an English teacher for 22 years, so it will not surprise you that I want to define our terms. I think well-meaning people in AA who honestly don't know any better refer to anyone in their family as an Al-Anon. So just to make it clear, an Al-Anon is a member of an Al-Anon family group who attends meetings regularly and who works the program. And if you hear anyone else talking about Al-Anon, don't pay any attention because that person is uninformed. People like that are not carrying the message, they are spreading the disease. And we have too many of them. I first learned some things that Al-Anon is not. We are not cookie bakers and coffee makers. And we are not AA groupies. Okay? And the Al-Anon program is not a therapeutic tool for the treatment of alcoholism. It does in no way promise to save marriages, only sanity. And happily ever after does not always mean walking hand in hand into the sunset. Happily ever after means my personal recovery. This program is for me. I had been with you all less than a year when my mother died. She was 58, and that is not young, but it's young to die, and I thought I could not stand it. I was in Texas, and she was in Florida, and I flew home some four or five times during the 6 months of her final illness. And the last time I was able to visit her, I had stepped out into the hall because I was crying, and a woman in the room across the hall, whom I have never seen before or since, beckoned me into her room. And when I went in, she said, "Your mother's going to be all right." And I said, "Oh, you don't understand. Her illness is terminal." And she said, "I didn't say she's going to get well. I said she's going to be all right." And Mother did not get well. And she has been all right ever since. And it's as if when I got to you, you had said to me, "You're going to be all right." And I would have said, "Oh, but my husband is barely sober. And you would have said, we didn't say you'd have a sober husband. We said, you're going to be all right. Or if you had said that, I might have said, I have a very fragile, sick marriage. And you would have said, we didn't promise to save your marriage, but you're going to be all right. And I have been. And even better than that, I know that I will be. Well, our story is disclosed in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I agree with Father Martin, who says that when he is up here, no, got it backwards, when he is out there, and you are up here, he says, you are playing with my life. Don't tell me how sick you got without telling me how well you have gotten. And so I want to spend at least a large portion of the hour I'm allowed talking about recovery, because I would be denying the grace of God in my life if I acted as if I had no recovery. In 20 years, my word, you know, you haven't been listening if you don't have some. I was born and grew up in Florida, fourth generation Floridians. We were not tourists. That was a bad word. Anytime I wanted to do something unladylike, my mother would say, don't act like a tourist. My father was a charming, handsome, intelligent, sensitive alcoholic. And he was also violent. And I was a badly battered child. I was not, thank God, ever sexually abused. And it was a number of years before I could say from the podium that I was a battered child. It needs to be said. It happens sometimes in alcoholic homes. And that was the case with us. We lived in a very blighted area of town because we were so dirt poor. I don't mean we didn't have any luxuries. I mean there was not enough to eat for days and days on end. There was inadequate clothing and inadequate shelter. And I have to tell you that to say, even in that area, the neighborhood children were not allowed to play with me. I know now that their parents must have felt some apprehension about what was going on at our house. But I didn't know it then, and I just felt rejection and rage. And I thought, I'll get back at them some way, somehow, and it turned out I could do that in school. I could beat the socks off of them, and I did, and I relished every minute of it. And I think that's about when I bought into a set of man-made rules that I lived by and that served to make me pretty sick before I ever got to you and learned about spiritual laws. But that's a little later on. I was really learning the rules then. When I was 8, my parents were divorced. My mother remarried a couple of years after that, a man that, as it happened, didn't drink at all. We were never close, but we felt genuine affection for each other. And things got a little better. There were still no luxuries, but we had enough to eat. And it seemed enormously better to me. And the way I got to Texas was that I wanted to go to school out there. Now, I come from a long line of Irish peasants who don't trust book learning. And I'm the oldest of 21 first cousins. And I was the first one to decide I wanted to go to college. Since then, a great many others have, and I remind them that I blazed the trail there. The thinking was that, if you want to go to college, no one quite understood how or why, and certainly no one could pay for it. But if I could pay for it, go right ahead. My mother did say, if you go to school in Texas, make up your mind that you'll spend the rest of your life out there, because she said you'll end up marrying a Texan and they don't transplant. I told her I was going to do no such thing, but I did, and they don't, and I have. And so, you know, she was right about that, as she was everything else. I wanted to go to Baylor University, and that's where it happens to be. I didn't date anyone who drank. This was not self-righteousness. This was stark terror. I had had drinking, thank you. And Charles did not drink at all when we married. And yet I think it inevitable that I find myself an alcoholic to marry, because the first man I ever loved, my father, was of course alcoholic, and that was my male orientation. And I know now that we don't just get sick as a result of being married to an alcoholic, that sick people marry sick people, and they rear sick children. And don't let anyone tell you anything different. I reared a couple of those children, and I taught many, many, many others. And when I hear someone say, I'm so grateful the drinking in our home didn't affect our children, my flesh crawls, you know? And I think if you believe that, I've got some swampland in Florida I'd like to talk to you about. You believe anything. Of course we find each other. Of course we have matching neuroses. The Al-Anons in California, I believe I'm quoting right, say every pot finds a lid that will fit it. And in Colorado, they say the horns on the heads of the alcoholics just fit the holes in ours. The drinking began very casually at our house and got so bad so fast. I feel as if we were blindsided by alcoholism. I truly did not see it coming. I know that I had an obsessive need to be needed, because that's how I got my feelings of worth and value. I didn't feel a sense of worth just by existing. But if I could be rescuing, I felt validated as a human being. So of course I found someone who would need me and who would see to it that I rescued regularly. And none of this was conscious, but for many years we nourished each other's neuroses. We did not have an involvement. We had a very sick entanglement. During those years, I don't know about your house, but we had some slogans we lived by before we got to you, and you gave us some others. One of them was, "What will people think?" Did you have that one? "Don't rock the boat. It's not that bad yet." Remember? And did you ever play "Guess What I'm Mad At"? Of course you did. Charles used to say I could ask him a question, answer it myself, and go away mad. I did all the wrong things during the drinking years. I know now I did the best I could at my level of enlightenment, and I've had to let go of my guilt over this. But I protected him whenever possible from the consequences of his drinking, and I rescued him whenever that was possible, and he was almost literally loved to death. And that can happen. And I did not know that I was keeping him sick that much longer. I lied and I played "Let's Pretend." And I did it as obsessively as he ever drank. One of the requirements for Al-Anon is this tremendous obsession with an alcoholic. It's an Al-Anon trait, at least before we get any help it is. In fact, they talk about the Al-Anon who was drowning. Have you heard about that one? Somebody else's life flashed in front of her eyes. I would like you to think that I stayed with this man out of love and loyalty, but I did not. And when I'm this far from the Deep South, I have to explain a little bit about pride. At least women of my generation in the Deep South were given a particular kind of upbringing. We were expected to flutter our eyelashes and flash our dimples and swish our skirts, but it was understood that we were made of steel and we could cope. And one did not air one's dirty linen in public. And you did not live with a man and criticize him to other people. And those were the rules, and I was living by the rules. That way, if you didn't like me, you would at least respect me. And people did. So my answer was try harder. I don't know whether you read the Peanuts cartoon strip. I hope you do. The greatest philosophy being published in this country today is in it. There's one where Sally, Charlie Brown's little sister, is learning long division, and she says to him, "How many times will 24 go into 12? And he says, "24 won't go into 12. And she says, "It will if you push." That was my answer. Try to force solutions. Just try harder. You see, I had no understanding of nor tolerance for people who messed up their lives, because I could match inauspicious beginnings with anybody I knew. And I had married considerably above myself. Charles used to say I shouldn't say that. I don't know any other way to say it. I married into a family that had had a great deal of money and still had a great deal of prestige. And no one was not allowed to play with me anymore. And that was so important to me. And I didn't want to risk this, and I didn't want to lose it. But I used to look at this handsome and brilliant and charming man and think, I don't know why you drink. I mean, I'm the one that had all the messed up upbringing. If anyone should drink, I would be the one. it was so difficult for me to accept that there were people who couldn't cope, because my thinking was that if I could, anybody could. And I had trouble with that for quite a long time. I said I didn't know I was keeping the wrong rules. All along, I had been extremely religious, not spiritual. And I have to say this carefully. I know there are people who are both. And I know there are people who are one or the other. But I was religious. That was another way of keeping the rules. And I don't regret that now. At that time, that was important for me. It was a handhold on God. And I did a few other things right during those years. I never called him a drunk. I never thought of him that way. I was married to a fine man who drank too much. And I knew at some level that he was sick. That nobody would be that way because he wanted to be. I didn't criticize him to the children. Well, not until he got sober. Then I could gripe. But not while he was drinking. And so when he was ready eventually to reach out tentatively in love to them, they were willing and waiting to be loved. I had a few friends who gave me understanding, although there was no way they could understand. You know how that happens? And I had a doctor who served as Al-Anon until I found you. And I say that because he used to say, you must do what is necessary for your sanity and your serenity regardless. And he knew just which button to push. He would say, your children need one stable parent. Well, need was the magic word. And I, of course, what little taking care of myself I did during that time, I did because he gave me permission. It was this doctor who suggested I return to teaching. I had taught school before my children were born, but the rules said a good mother did not work outside her home. And I stayed home for 12 years while they were little, and I don't regret that either. That was what I wanted to do. But he wrote return to teaching on a prescription pad one day and gave it to me. I will tell you that at that time I had severe incapacitating migraine two or three times a week, and I have three forms of arthritis that have been diagnosed since I was in my 20s. And this is the woman who said to you a year later, I'm fine, thank you. There's nothing wrong with me if you'll just help my husband. And so when I returned to teaching, there were those who suggested that having 150 17-year-olds every day would not be therapeutic. There were even those who said that if you weren't already sick, that might do it. I try never to talk without saying, don't criticize kids to me. You're going to have to fight me first. And I bet I know more of them than you do. I have collected several thousand through the years. And although I'm not teaching right now, I miss it so much I sometimes just ache. I would like you to think that I miss enlightening the youth of America. What I miss is spending 8 hours a day with people who thought I was pretty neat. That's what I miss. I like their gung-ho eagerness for living, and I like the touching. I like their concern for this planet that my generation did not know. I think their values are sounder. They are not as hung up on things. Of course, it wasn't one long honeymoon. There were times when I wished for retroactive birth control, but not usually. What happened was that Charles never quit trying to find an answer. And I did then, and I do now. I respect him greatly for that. He went to ministers and lay counselors and doctors, medical, and both our local psychiatrists. And nobody knew what was wrong with him. He drank at home. I didn't suspect alcoholism because his pattern was not that of my father. He was certainly never violent. And he says when he talks that drinking at home is guaranteed to raise the crop of Al-Anons and Alateens. He was not arrested or put in the hospital because he was protected and sheltered so carefully. There was a woman living in our town in West Texas at that time who was a family counselor. Strange, eccentric lady. It'll tell you something about her when I tell you that when he called for an appointment, the appointment was at 12:30 a.m. And it'll tell you something about him when I tell you he was there. He kept it. And they had been seeing each other for about 6 weeks. I remember it so well. I was still home from school for the Christmas holidays, and it was January of 1964, and she called me. Are there moments in your life that are so lucid that they're engraved in your memory and in infinite detail? I remember the room. I remember everything about it. And she told me her name, and of course I recognized it, and she said, your husband is an alcoholic, and this is a family illness. I need to talk to you, too. And all of my deep South upbringing went out the window, and I said, you're out of your mind, and hung up. Now, that is not the way I was brought up. See, if you don't like somebody, you're supposed to be kind but cool. But she had hit a nerve, and I didn't want to talk about it. And before I could leave the room, the phone rang again, and when I said hello, she said, "Don't hang up. Hey, listen, I know what you've been through." Well, she couldn't know. Nobody could know, because I hadn't told anybody. And I, who thought that all the tears had long since been shed, stood there with that phone in my hand, and I cried and I cried and I cried. So that was your first gift to me, the freedom to cry. I cry anytime I please now. Charles used to say I could cry reading menus or telephone directories. Not quite, but sometimes I cry at television commercials. You know, remember the one where they bring home the new baby and the little boy, nose is a little bit out of joint because it's the baby sister, and they're talking about her blue eyes, and he looks in the mirror and he says, "Mine were blue first." Well, I just come unglued every time I see it. And I used to cry at pep rallies at school. I have to tell you that the high school where I taught, which is one of the finest I've ever been connected with anyway, football was second only to oxygen in importance. And a pep rally was akin to a Broadway production. And I used to look at those marvelous young people who felt 10 feet tall and thought they had the world by the tail and think what a tough row some of them would be hoeing. And it still gets me a little choked up when I think about it. So I learned to cry. It was this counselor who suggested that we see you people. And we did. And for 6 months, I went only to open meetings. And if anyone had the questionable judgment to invite me to Al-Anon, I was kind but cool. And I explained that I had not done the drinking, so I did not need the therapy. And if my husband quit drinking, there would be no problems at our house. I cannot even say it with a straight face today, but that's what I told him. And I wouldn't go to any meeting where he was due to get a memento of sobriety. Do you people give those? We had poker chip key rings. I didn't want to hear him say, "My name is Charles and I'm an alcoholic." I told you I could say, "Let's pretend." The 4th of July weekend that year, we went to San Antonio, which is very beautiful. If you're ever in Texas, don't miss it. We had lived there for 4 years, and our babies were born there, and we went back every chance we could. And Charles got drunk, and he says, "I must never say it was a slip. It was a carefully planned drunk. It was not the worst one, nor the longest one." And I know now that I wasn't surprised. I really didn't expect him to quit drinking. That was an attitude that must have helped him a lot, too, looking back. And I was driving home. He never drove drinking or hungover. And he said, "I've got to tell my group about this. I'm due to get a 6-month chip next week." And in my appalling ignorance, I said, "I won't tell anybody." And he had to explain to me that that wasn't the name of the game. I had to tell you that to say this is what got my attention. This is a man to whom I had been married at that time for 14 years, and he had never once said to me, "I'm sorry. I was wrong. I made a mistake." And he was going to go down there and say it to some people he had known 6 months, and I was mad. So I figured I would go back and take a second look. And I used to get to this part of my story and say there was a particular woman who invited me to Al-Anon then, and I don't know why her invitation reached me when no one else has had. Well, I have done 3, I think, very thorough and comprehensive inventories and fifth steps in 20 years. And God, in his infinite wisdom, tells me more about myself than I'm interested in knowing. And in the very first one, he told me why I could hear her invitation and I hadn't heard anyone else's. That's because she was someone that I thought was as good as I was. I'm sorry. I wish it were a more noble reason. But she had everything I considered important. She had brains and breeding and beauty and intelligence and social position. She still has everything I consider important, but it's certainly a different list today. And it takes what it takes. And I believe God sends us the people we can hear. And I could not have heard anyone else then. For 6 months, I sulked and sulked. You know, there's a line in one of our pieces of literature that says, "While sobriety can be a welcome miracle, it does not guarantee happiness." And we had a very stormy and difficult sobriety. I believe I'm quoting Bill Wilson accurately, who wrote, "We consider that man unthinking who says that sobriety is enough. It is essential, but it is not enough." And our first 18 months with you were unmitigated hell. They were worse than anything we had ever had drinking. Charles was stark, raving sober, and very much aware of all of my defects of character, and no longer held back by guilt from mentioning them loudly and clearly and frequently. As Clancy says, when the alcohol is gone, the ism remains. I mentioned how good we all are, we who are in Al-Anon, at fantasizing and at pretending. It often happens that when we live with an alcoholic, father, mother, husband, wife, son, daughter, we seem to feel that if that person were not drinking, he or she would be the person of our dreams, you know? The mother of our dreams, the father, whoever. And certainly I thought if Charles didn't drink, he would be the husband of my dreams. And he got to you and found out that if he wanted to stay sober, he'd better be who he is. And he was somebody I had not met. You know, I didn't know. You told me that marriages made in sickness often do not survive health. And I didn't want to hear you. But eventually I was forced to listen to you. Well, we get to Al-Anon in pretty bad shape, most of us. It's as if during the drinking years, now this was not on any conscious level, but it's as if I had thought to myself, all feelings have valves or faucets, and I'm going to turn off the one marked anger. I'm going to turn off the one marked self-pity or resentment. And what I did not know was there's one valve and it's marked feelings. And I got to you emotionally frozen. And you literally loved me back to life. And living where you do, I don't have to tell you that when something which has been frozen has the life come back into it, there is pain. And for a long time when I hurt in a new place, it was still an unthawed little pocket somewhere where I had remained so frozen. I think they're all gone now. We come in behind defensive walls. And a wall need not be withdrawal. Compulsive talking can be a wall. You never get to know anyone who never shuts up. And certainly that person never gets to know us. My wall was busyness. There were people in my group who said that during the drinking, they pulled down the shades and didn't answer the phone or the door. I joined everything in town and ran most of them. And I was rather hurt when I'd been with you 2 or 3 weeks and no one asked me to be president. I thought you obviously didn't know who I was. The barrenness of busyness was my wall. If I kept running hard enough, it could be like a narcotic and I wouldn't have to stop and think. By the way, I no longer batter down people's walls. If you have one, it's because you need it. And I think sometimes if we keep on it, that it's like an emotional rape. It is forcing ourselves on people who are not ready. And I've quit doing that. I think that perhaps if that person looks out through the chink in his armor and we smile and let him know the natives are friendly, we encourage him to let the wall down himself, and maybe if we love him enough, the bricks will thaw. At least that's what happened to me. And I began to hear about this program, and not from one person and not all at once. I had a sponsor who was gentle and firm. She was a black belt Al-Anon. I promise you, she is exactly what I needed. And from her and from others, I began to hear. We used to say in our group, you don't hear the answer until you've asked the question. And you don't ask any questions if you think you know all the answers. Does that make sense? So I got to you thinking I knew them all, and it was a long time before I could hear anything. So I did begin to hear people say, do you realize that you're sick too? That this is really a family illness? And finally I could accept that. And then, do you want to get well? They said, a lot of people need their neuroses. Take a look and see. You may not want to let go of it. And I really looked at that one a long time. And I decided I wanted to get well and I would go to any length for that. If I had known then the lengths to which I would have to go, I think I might have turned and run. And they said, we cannot teach anyone who already knows everything. Would you be willing to give up some old ideas? Well, I had been to open meetings, and I had heard Chapter 5 read, and I knew about giving up the old ideas. And they had to, you know, be gone. And so I began to give up some things I had been taught. My sponsor said, we can't put new wine in an old bottle. God can only fill an empty vessel, she said. Empty yourself out of some of this learning that is erroneous. And I had a great deal to unlearn. Mark Twain says in writing about his book, Huckleberry Finn, he says, it is better to follow a sound heart than a deformed conscience. And I think without meaning to, people deform our consciences by teaching us things that just are not true. For instance, I was brought up, and I'll bet you were too, God helps those who help themselves. He does not, you know. God helps those who ask. And at the times I have needed him most desperately, I could not have helped myself if my life had depended on it, and it very nearly did. God helps those who ask. And I was brought up that mature people don't ask for help. I wouldn't ask for directions in a strange town. I would buy a map. I guess if I'd broken my leg, I would have tried to set it. I'm not sure. And you told me that babies are dependent and adolescents are independent. They go through the I'll do it myself phase, which is normal for them at that age, but that adults are interdependent. And I know today that some pain is necessary for my spiritual education, but misery is optional. And I do not opt to be miserable anymore. If you could take a look at my long-distance charges, you would know that I don't hurt very long before I reach out to somebody, and so far there has always been a hand there. I was brought up that I would put other people first always, weren't you? And you told me, oh no, you said, you have not only a right but a responsibility to take care of yourself, including emotionally. See, when you would say take care of yourself, I thought you meant eat properly and get enough rest. And then I learned, so slowly as I learned everything else, that it's up to me to take care of myself emotionally, and I'm absolutely shameless about the way I do it now. At the risk of sounding like a heretic, I will tell you that sometimes I say no to Al-Anon. Every time that phone rings, it is not God calling. And I have learned to say no. I have to say no. And I say no far more often than I say yes, or when I do come to you, I would have nothing to bring you. Listen, I'm not talking about me first. I'm talking about my turn. And I didn't even know how to take that until I got to you. And I had a sponsor who said, ask yourself before anything, is it in my best interest? Now, see, as long as we are obsessed with someone else, taking care of, rescuing, lying for, thinking about, manipulating someone else, we never have to look at ourselves. And it was very difficult to put down that magnifying glass that I had held over my husband and pick up a mirror. And that's what you told me to do. And she said, you don't have to like any situation, but it is imperative that you like yourself in it. And those are the two questions I ask now before any major thing. What is in my best interest? And what will enable me to be comfortable with myself in this situation? I was brought up, you were too. What you don't know can't hurt you. What I didn't know nearly killed four people. You know, what you don't know can kill you. And so, slowly, I began to unlearn so that I could relearn these spiritual truths that you were teaching me. And I discovered that I am very greedy for this program. I was unwilling to settle for a spiritual band-aid. I would not settle for the crumbs when the banquet was spread. And I am attracted to other people who are greedy for it and who want everything there is. And I began to get a little tiny grasp of the spiritual laws and found they are just as real and irrevocable as the law of gravity. If I jump out of a tall building, I go down, not up. I have not broken the law of gravity. I have just illustrated it. You know, I have just proved that it's sure enough, it is the law, isn't it? And you said to me, resentments will make you sick. That's a spiritual law. And if I didn't believe you, and if I hung on to them, and the migraine came back, and the arthritis came back, I had not broken that spiritual law. I had just illustrated it. And I did it time and again before I realized that I really didn't have to. And these spiritual truths, these laws, are much more exacting than all the man-made rules I had been following. It's easier to stay within the speed limit and not to cheat on my income tax than it is to love you unconditionally. But I do this afternoon, and you have nothing to say about it. I do it because it won't hurt you, and it's a whole lot more fun for me. And it's part of my therapy. And I learned that the worst immorality is judgment. Of course, I learned the basic Al-Anon teaching of all, which is release. Get off of his back, get out of his way, get to work on yourself, they told me. If you don't like the warts, let go of the frog. We had a workshop this morning on detachment and release. A lot of good things said. I wish you could all have been there. And I told them that sometimes I have to release with anger before I can with love. And sometimes I have to withdraw emotionally before I can let go at all. And that everything I've ever released in my life has claw marks all over it. But generally speaking, I am able to do it today. I'm able to be involved with you without being entangled. And I can detach from your problems, not you, but from your problems. And this keeps me sane and makes me a great deal more helpful to you. I learned that God could work directly through my husband and children. I didn't know that. I thought he had to come through me. I had always told them God's will for their lives. They didn't even have to ask, usually. And to find that they had their own relationship with him came as kind of a surprise. I think that's a symptom of untreated Al-Anonism, Russian and rescue. I am slowly able today to listen to your feelings without trying to fix you. Now, every cell of my being wants to fix you. But most of the time, I'm able to listen without telling you what to do. I was so surprised when I got into Al-Anon, I was told that we don't give advice. I thought, how in the world can we help anybody? And they said, well, what we can usually do is help someone see what the available options are. You see, when I got into this fellowship, I thought I had three options. I could divorce Charles. I could live with him while we both tried to recover in our programs. Or I could have a close, warm, loving, communicative marriage. And I opted for number three. And unfortunately, that was not one of my available options. And any time I'm miserable today, it's because I have chosen something that was not an available option. And I need you to help me see what my options are, and just as important, what they are not. And that's what we do for each other instead of giving advice. And I gave up translating. Did you ever translate? Now, honey, what your daddy meant was, you did, I can tell. My children were in Alateen for 10 years each. I had a choice during those drinking years. I could stay or not. Those kids had no choice. There'll be a special place in heaven for Alateen sponsors. I could tell you at length how much their father had damaged them. And when I got to Al-Anon, they made me look at how much I had damaged them, and I thought I could not stand it. We cannot generalize, but most of the time, children resent the non-alcoholic more. Well, at our house, for all they could see, their father was asleep on the sofa. They didn't know passed out. And here was this crazy woman yelling and screaming and throwing things. You know, which one would you resent? I was the heavy, I was the villain. And they are young adults now, and they say to me sometimes, I try to remember that you were sick too. And because you gave them this intensive care for so long, they never had to do drugs. They almost never drank. They haven't even ever had a cavity. I think it's important that you know, those of you with young children, that the damage can be healed and the children can lead normal, productive, happy, healthy lives. And you really don't have to go through all that hell every time.
Your machine and turn your tape over for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this point, please stop your machine, turn your tape over, wait for a few seconds, and the talk will start. Thank you. At this point, please stop your machine, turn your tape over, wait for a few seconds.
On the other hand, you're entirely responsible for yourself. Now, anyone married to an alcoholic has a built-in whipping boy. Anything that goes wrong, you can blame on the problem. And as I said, it enables us to avoid looking at ourselves, and it makes a wonderful out for whatever is going on. The first, fourth, and fifth step I did taught me that I had come into my marriage with every defect of character I ever had. These defects would have caused me trouble in any marriage, and very likely would have made me sick. I had to, you took the wind out of my sails because you took away my scapegoat. And I had to be responsible for myself. I see that now as a freedom. I didn't then. But I was really in emotional slavery. I didn't know how to respond. I just reacted. If Charles got angry, I got angry. If he got depressed, I got depressed. I thought this meant we were close. It's as if I waked up every morning and said to him, good morning, how do I feel today? because it depended on him. You told me never to say never and never to say always, but I hope I never again have a relationship in which I turn that much power over to someone else. I hope I never again turn all of my self-worth over to someone else on a platter and say, here, what I think of me depends on you. To his credit, he never asked for that. I did that. But I learned that I could take my sails out of his wind. And neither he nor anyone else determines the direction in which I go today. And I will take the freedom and I will also take the responsibility. He told me, of course, that I must quit looking to people for what only God could provide. That he was the source and that people are the channels, and the channel might change, but the source never would. And I've had occasion to think of that a great deal the last 3 years when there have been so many changes in my life. You talked to me about love and you said it is not dependency. And unless it's free, it isn't love at all. But if we ever say, I love you if, we're not loving. I said to my sponsor, I can't love anyone for free. And she said, you already love your children that way. And I thought about it, and nothing they can do would make me love them more, and nothing they could do would make me love them less. It truly is an absolute. And I can't love everyone quite that unconditionally, but I can do it a great deal better today than I ever thought I could. Now listen, I didn't learn the whole program at once, and I still don't have it all. I learned it slowly and painfully, incident by incident, one day at a time. And some days I still think, what program? God who? And there's always someone I can call, and that person will tell me what program and God who, usually in the words I have used to tell them. Don't you hate that? And they say, well, as you've told me, and I say, don't do that to me. I don't need that today. And you said, I don't have to be perfect, and that practice makes progress. And then you said, recovery is progressive too. And the weller we get, the weller we can get. English teachers are allowed to make up their own words. It's in our contract. Of course I talk the talk better than I walk the walk. Of course I do. And I walk the walk better than I feel the feeling. But I'm still the best lunch I've ever had today. And I live on the growing edge, as I believe anyone does who stays in this fellowship. I think we either grow or we quit coming because we get so uncomfortable we can't come. And so what I am learning today is just as new and scary to me as anything you're learning after 1 year or two or three. It may be at a different place, but it's new to me, and I need a hand to hold while I look around corners. There's always been a hand there. I'm absolutely awed by the new people today who come in and hit this program running. You know why? 20 years ago, we didn't have us. Do you understand what I mean? There was no one who had been around 5, 10, 15, or 20 years. My sponsor had 13 months. I thought she knew everything. And then we had one hardback book and maybe 10 pamphlets. And it's a joy to watch them, but I have to remember that we were coming from behind. These children, whom you took such good care of for so long, are fine today, thank you. And I mean literally, thank you. I'm laughing because I sound like a doting mother, and I'm going to go ahead and do it. My son is a photographer in Dallas, a commercial photographer. He's very, very good at it. Last year he won a Clio, which is the absolute highest award you can win in advertising, and it's his because he's in business for himself. He doesn't work for an agency. We date the people we meet, and he meets models. And so when I visit with him, usually at the Dallas airport, when I'm en route somewhere, if you leave Texas, you go to Dallas first, you know. But when you die before you go to heaven or hell, you'll go to Dallas first. And he comes out to the airport to visit with me, and he has one of these gorgeous young things on his arm. They always weigh 36 pounds and have legs up to their armpits. Him that if I want to feel frumpy, I can stay home and iron. I don't have to look at these young people. These children are good to me. In the very old-fashioned sense of the word, they are good to me. For Christmas, he gave me a book entitled Guide to Montreal, and I thought, how neat. And he said, open it, and inside there was the money for the trip. And I used to wonder when I was little, and my mother would remark that someone was good to his mother. I thought, well, of course, you know, what else? Well, I have lived to learn, what else? And I am so grateful, grateful for these kids. A few years ago, our daughter was married. And because you told her that she could be who she is, this girl who never gave us anything but joy, ever, I don't mean this was trouble, but when she was planning the wedding, she said, there's no rule that says my attendant has to be a girl. And the person I love best in the world is my brother, and I'm going to ask him to stand with me. And before I could mention anything, share my wisdom with her, her brother said, okay, I've never been a bride's person before. And the groom said, well, in that case, I'm closer to my sister, but we're getting ahead of me, than I am my brothers, and so I think I'll ask her to stand with me. It will balance the wedding party. So we had a best woman and a man of honor. It was an absolutely beautiful wedding, and I sat there crying in the time-honored fashion of the mother of the bride, thinking sobriety made this possible, as it truly did. Now, I'm going to have to close by telling you something that I'm afraid you'll hear as bad news. Please don't. Please hear this as what was necessary next for my recovery and for Charles. You know, relationships like people sometimes die. And we lost our marriage, actually about in 1977, for a variety of reasons that it would not be at all appropriate for me to go into from behind a podium. We tried for 3 more years to revive it, but it was like giving artificial respiration to a corpse. There was nothing there for us to go back to. Because people who love us always want to know, I have taken to saying, he did not leave me for another woman. I did not throw him out for another man. And he did not resume drinking. He had 20 years sobriety last July. But our recovery has taken us down different roads and in different directions. And for reasons I do not understand, something toxic happens when we try to relate to each other. That does not happen when we relate to other people. And it became such a destructive relationship, and we care too much for each other to destroy each other. And we realized we could not gain any further recovery within the framework of a marriage that was really damaged beyond repair, that was sick, you know, beyond healing. So in April of 1980, we released each other with dignity and respect, we really did, to find new lives and new directions. And our divorce was final in August of that year. We have tried to remain friendly, but I would be lying if I said we were friends. We are not. Friends share feelings. Friends joy in each other's presence. If we could have done that, we could have stayed married. You can live with a friend. But I can tell you that there's no villain and no one is wearing a black hat. Lest you think this is a storybook divorce, I will tell you that I have been infuriated that this man has been able, with his new friends and for the last year, a new wife, to do and be everything I always hoped he would do and be. And he either could not or would not within the framework of our marriage. I have said this to him or I would not be saying it to you. It seems to me these people are getting effortlessly everything I yearned for 30 years. And there are times when I'm pretty sane and I think, how neat that he's getting that much recovery. And the rest of the time, I am just enraged that it did not come in time to do anything for our relationship. Listen, nobody wants divorce. I wanted us to grow old together. I had envisioned our watching our grandchildren playing, putting our teeth in the same glass on the nightstand. I did not plan to be past 50 and single. Whole new world out there. And yet I never felt more direct guidance. I was never more helpfully Al-Anon than when I said I'm going to any lengths for my recovery. The children, because you never let go of them, were mutually supportive. The weekend that Charles moved out, our son flew out from Dallas to help him move, and he alternated moving a piece of furniture to his father's apartment and holding me while I cried. And then he'd move something else for his father, and then he'd sit on the sofa and hold me and let me cry. And 2 weeks after the divorce was final, it was our daughter who called and said, this would have been your 30th wedding anniversary. I know it's been a difficult day for you. Ending a 30-year marriage is like an amputation. It is necessary for survival, but the agony is intense, and there is phantom pain where the relationship used to be. And I will always regret its necessity, as I would regret any amputation. And you know, you told me that the tragedy of suffering is not that it happens, but that we let it be wasted, and I must never back God into a corner and say, why me? I mean, after all, why not me? But I must ask him, what am I supposed to understand? So that's what I have been trying to do. And the answers aren't all in, but I do have a few of them. And I'll share those with you. I'm supposed to understand, for instance, that I don't have to know what the future holds, because I know who holds the future. I'm supposed to understand that God and I are enough. We really are. And for a woman of my generation, this is a real milestone. I'm a whole person without a man. And that means any men in my life today are there because we want it, and not because one of us has a loose umbilical cord that we're trying to plug into the other one, you know? And I promise you, it's better to have a relationship out of choice. I can only make one major decision a year, so it was 1981 when I decided that I would rather live somewhere else. The desert has its own kind of charm, but I had always loved the hill country of Texas. And I decided to go to graduate school. I decided to get another degree. And I began investigating, and I ended up at the University of Texas in Austin. I took the graduate record exam and moved to Austin in 1982. It was difficult beyond belief to leave the house where my children grew up. It was hard to pull up those roots. And I kept remembering that I could take the memories with me, and that anywhere I live is God's house. Oh, you would laugh to see me in graduate school. I keep wanting to teach the class. If the professor doesn't explain adequately, I want to say, honey, what he means. I keep wanting to correct the professor's grammar. I do know better than that. And the kids are marvelously polite, but they do not part like the Red Sea when I walk down the hall, as I was accustomed to. I have everything finished now, 54 hours, and I'm writing my thesis. And I'll either be through in May or August, depending on how fast I do it. And the degree will be in counseling psychology, and I will, of course, work with students. I think you can tell that's where my heart is. And I'm going to be okay. You told me 20 years ago that I was going to be all right. I was listening to a fifth step a few years ago, and the man said to me that during his wife's drinking, he had been so obsessed that he had missed his children's childhood. He said, I missed so many present moments. And I liked the term, and I thought, I don't want to miss any present moments. Tommy Green, AA up in Winnipeg, says the way you don't miss the present moment is to ask yourself, how am I conscious of God right now, this minute? Well, I'm conscious of him right now, this minute, because you did what I asked you to do. You loved me back while I was talking, and I thank you for that. And I thank you for being who you are and whose you are.